National Security This Week, a weekly look at American national security issues. And now, your host, John Olson.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, November 10th, and you've joined us for this edition of National Security This Week. I'm your host, John Olson. Every Wednesday at 9 a.m., we get together here on KYMN Radio to discuss national security, and we're joined by guests from our local area, from around Minnesota, and from across the nation to help us explore those challenges. I promised you early in the development of this weekly show that we touch on topics that are important, but that rarely get any meaningful coverage through other media outlets. And I think we have just a show just like that for you today. And for this show, we're going to talk about a nation that sits at the frontier between Europe and the East. This nation has become a vital member of NATO and directly faces a rising partnership between Russia and Belarus. The nation also shares a border with Ukraine, which is another country under constant pressure from Russia. So today's topic is Poland, and we're going to talk Polish politics, economics, and security policy. That's on our agenda today. So pour yourself a cup of coffee, and settle in for a great discussion. Our guest today is Dr. Mary Curtin. Dr. Curtin, a Minnesota native, joined the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota as diplomat in residence in 2013 after a 25-year career as a Department of State Foreign Service officer. As diplomat in residence, she teaches courses in foreign policy and diplomacy and serves as head of the global policy area at the Humphrey School, where she was also instrumental in creating the new Master of Human Rights degree. During her foreign service career, Dr. Curtin served at the U.S. mission to the EU in Brussels, as political counselor in Warsaw, Poland, and at missions in Tunisia, Mali, and Chile, as well as in Washington, D.C. She has expertise in European affairs, Middle East policy, human rights, democratization, and nonproliferation. She was also a member of the U.S. delegation to the 1995 U.N. Conference on Women. Dr. Mary Curtin earned a B.A. from the University of Notre Dame and a doctorate in history from Columbia University, writing her dissertation on Hubert H. Humphrey and the politics of the Cold War from 1943 to 54. She also earned an additional master's degree in security studies from the U.S. Army War College in 2003. And Dr. Curtin speaks French, Polish, and Spanish. Dr. Mary Curtin, welcome to National Security This Week.
Thank you, John. I'm happy to be here.
And where are you at this morning? You and I are on Zoom, but where are you at this morning?
So I'm at my home in Minneapolis and am hoping that my research assistant, my little poodle, doesn't have anything to say during the show.
Well, so we love dogs here at the station, so if we hear a little barking, we know that maybe a squirrel showed up outside the window. So, Dr. Curtin, let's kick off our discussion today by covering a little bit of your career path. You're from Minnesota. What was your path in service to America in the Department of State? I mean, how'd you get into that career path?
So, I joined the Foreign Service after I finished my PhD, and like a lot of people, had a lot of different ideas during my 20s about, what I wanted to do in my career. I originally heard of the Foreign Service at a high school career night. And, I like to remind people that those sparks that you put into young people's heads sometimes can be really important. I was interested in political history and history of foreign policy, but gradually became more interested in being part of the foreign policy process making. I also really wanted the opportunity to live in and not just visit other countries. And so rather than pursue an academic career, as I finished my PhD, I decided to take the Foreign Service test and was lucky enough to become a member of the Foreign Service in 1986.
And that process of taking the exam and going through all of the interviews, how long did that take, do you recall?
Well, it one thing that has not changed is that it can be a very long process. In my case, it was close to 2 years, taking the test, going for follow-up oral interviews several months later, passing that, going through long security clearances, and then being on a register that really depends on the budget and the hiring numbers that the State Department has. So it was close to 2 years before I went in, which sometimes is still true today.
Yeah, and that's hard because a lot of people who are seeking career paths like this, they don't have often 2 years of just time to to sit back and wait for a decision from the federal government, do they?
Right. No, they don't. And I was like a lot of people, obviously, you know, I was pursuing a lot of other job opportunities, including working at the Congressional Research Service and doing some other things and making other career plans in case that Foreign Service job didn't work out.
Yeah. So your career at the State Department afforded you clearly some additional education, including in languages and security studies and whatnot. Mm-hmm. How important is that training for career national security professionals to prepare them for service in countries and regions around the world?
So that's a great question. The education that people get all the way through school and then in college or in graduate degree programs is really important. But as you know, with your military service, in-service training is also really critical. And it's something that the State Department seeks to increase its budget for and its personnel for so that it can afford Foreign Service officers even greater opportunities to do things like language training, leadership and management training, or the other things. So, for example, I did an entire year of Polish language and culture so that by the time, and that was my job, then by the time I arrived in Poland, I could speak Polish at a professional level and then had adequate support while in Poland to bring that even higher up. People who do things like manage embassies or manage our consular sections have even greater training requirements because of the legal and administrative requirements that really attach to their jobs. But I know, and then the State Department offers people at the, as they approach the senior level, opportunities like I had to do training at a university or at one of the service colleges. And so I was really fortunate to have the opportunity to spend a year at the Army War College, really come to understand the perspectives of people with whom we work very closely in the State Department.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things that I really appreciated about having the opportunity to serve as a naval attaché at the U.S. Embassy in Helsinki, Finland, was that understanding that, you know, State Department, career Foreign Service officers, and career military people like me, we take very different approaches to dealing with these international challenges, and I think they need to be complementary of one another in a strong interagency approach to foreign policy.
That's true, and one reason why the State Department really seeks out opportunities for officers to spend some time at one of the service colleges is that as you move along in your career, you work more closely with the military. And the State Department, because of budget issues over the years, doesn't have its own senior training facility in that same way. It has a large Foreign Service Institute that does all kinds of other training, including the very famous language school, political officer training, economics courses, all those things, but no longer has that sort of senior training that the service colleges offer.
And so talking about education and training, you teach at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs. Can you tell us a bit about the students who come to Humphrey, come there to learn about public policy, public affairs, other areas? So you lead the global policy area. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about who's studying there these days.
So the Humphrey School, as you know, John, has several different degree programs, and we are what's called a general school of public affairs rather than, say, a school of international affairs. And so within that, we have Master of Public Policy degree program, which is a sort of traditional two-year program in which students gain the basics of public policy and prepare for a career in the area that they are interested in. So, for example, a lot of students are from Minnesota. They plan to stay in Minnesota and work in areas like state and local government. For example, the mayor of St. Paul, the new Senate minority leader in the state legislature, and numerous other city administrators, state-level administrators, are Humphrey School graduates. There are also Humphrey School graduates in nonprofits and other organizations throughout Minnesota. There are also a significant number of students, both from Minnesota and other places, who choose to come to the Humphrey School to prepare for a career in global issues. And that could be in foreign policy, in development, you know, working for large human rights organizations, a number of things like that. And we see a lot of those students in the Master of Public Policy program. We also see students interested in those issues in our Master of Development Practice program, the Master of Human Rights program, and increasingly our Science, Technology, and Environmental Policy program, where students can really dive into the global climate issues and the policies that are needed to understand it and to come up with solutions for that. And of course, John, you know, we also have a mid-career program for students who have already embarked on and have significant experience in some kind of policy area, whether that's with a nonprofit or state and local, federal government, military or State Department, folks like yourself. And what's great is that we often have opportunities for those students to come together with all their different interests and learn not just from the faculty, but learn from each other and to create networks of both local and global practitioners that we think enriches that learning environment. So it's not just international affairs or just local. It covers a variety of interests. And some of our students have, one recent graduate, for example, spent several years at the city of Minneapolis and then took the Foreign Service test after about 5 or 6 years doing that and is now a Foreign Service officer.
All right.
Another great example of, you know, that crossover that we see with a lot of our students.
Yeah. While we're on the topic of the Humphrey School, full disclosure to the audience, I just served as a country team mentor in what was called the International Strategic Crisis Negotiation Exercise, an annual exercise that you run, Dr. Curtin. Mm-hmm. Can you tell the audience a little bit about what that is, the International Strategic Crisis Negotiation Exercise?
So that exercise is something that we do annually in partnership with the Army War College, which is really well known for developing these kinds of role-playing exercises for, in the first instance, mid and senior level Army officers to help them think about diplomatic issues beyond maybe their traditional focus on more purely military issues. So the scenarios, so that we play a different scenario every year based on real issues in the world, such as this year, the South tensions in the South China Sea. Other years, we've done exercises around Kashmir or North Korea, and students from really every degree program at the Humphrey School and several other faculties at the University of Minnesota, including some undergraduates, come together and are assigned to be on a team, say the China team. They're given background information and negotiating instructions, like what can you do? What are your goals? What can you not do? And then each team has a mentor like you, John, who is either a former State Department official or retired military or something like that, not to tell them what to do, but to sit in the corner and say, have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? And so our students benefit from the role playing. They learn a lot about how difficult it is in multilateral settings for countries to come to agreement, because each country, for example, in this exercise, you know, the Philippines and Malaysia and Indonesia are all, you know, concerned about what China is doing, but it's also difficult for them to come together and make agreement. And the students really learn that and really benefit from the expertise that we bring into the exercise.
Yeah, it sort of gives them a flavor of the complexity of how the real world works, which I think is good.
Yeah.
So for our audience, you're listening to KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. This is National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Dr. Mary Curtin, who serves as diplomat in residence at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs, and we're focusing on Poland today. So Dr. Curtin, let's go ahead and shift over to our main topic today,
Great.
Poland. When did you serve in Poland? I know you were the political officer there. So, what political counselor? What role did you have on the country team in that assignment? Maybe what other State Department assignments did you have that put you in contact with Polish officials?
So, I was in Poland at a really interesting time. I was there from 2004 until 2008. Subsequently, then after Poland, I went to the European Union mission. So I was in Brussels at the U.S. mission to the European Union, where I also worked closely with Polish diplomats because of the very engaged role with the EU that Poland had at that time. So, John, I was there not too long after Poland had become a member of NATO. And literally, I arrived weeks after it became a full member of the EU. Mm. And so it was a really interesting time for Poland and for U.S.-Polish relations. I was also there during the time of the so-called Orange Revolution in Ukraine, in which Polish officials were deeply engaged. And during my time, both in Poland and Brussels, the constantly recurring crises in Belarus erupted, calmed down, erupted and calmed down. And I arrived in Brussels right when Russia invaded Georgia. Hmm. On all those issues, Poland saw itself as a partner with the United States, the EU, NATO, for its own security and for the security of your other European states. So my job in Poland was as political counselor. What that means is that I was the head of the political section there. And because of our strong relationship with Poland, we had a pretty large political section. We worked closely with the economic section as Poland was undergoing pretty drastic and sometimes unpopular economic reform. We worked very closely with the Defense Attaché's office and the Office of Military Cooperation. It was a time in which the United States was seeking to negotiate a missile defense site in Poland. So we were very involved in those negotiations and which the Polish military was in the process of receiving F-16s from the United States that it had purchased as part of its movement away from Soviet era military equipment and doctrine over to U.S. based. So it was also sort of a tumultuous time in Poland. And so one of our jobs was to advise Washington on the political winds that were blowing at that time. While there was strong support for the EU, there very strong support for NATO, there was the debates that are going on in Poland now over, you know, who got left behind in the economic changes, whether or not Poland, you know, wanted to have the EU, quote, tell it what to do. Those debates were really nascent in that time. So during that time, I also served our deputy chief of mission, who is sort of the second in command, went to Iraq for a period of time. And so I served a long period of time where I was the acting deputy and then at times the acting chargé or head of the embassy. So I played a lot of leadership roles in coordinating our policy with Washington and within the embassy itself.
So I think our audience clearly understands the role you played while you were serving in Warsaw on the U.S. Embassy team. So let's talk about politics in Poland, since political parties, their platforms, and the results of elections have such an important impact on the path a country pursues. In the case of Poland, we know that the people of Poland elected a rather nationalistic party to lead them relatively recently. Mm-hmm. Can you give us a kind of a breakdown on Polish politics today?
So Polish politics, going back to, you know, the time that I was there in the sort of 2004 to 2008 period, is I think when you started to see the divisions in Polish politics that we see still today, with some changes. So the party that the Law and Justice Party that has been in power since 2015 is, I would say, extremely nationalistic. and has really built its reputation on the politics of grievance, it appealing to the sense among some Poles. And in Poland, where we talk about red and blue here, divisions in the United States, they talk about what they call Polska A and Polska B. So Poland A and Poland B. So Poland A is the Poland that feels it has benefited economically from the EU membership. They have good middle-class jobs. They've been able to buy homes. Their kids and maybe themselves now have been educated under EU programs in other countries. They travel. They want to be in the EU. They see themselves as good EU members. And the other side, Poland B, sees itself as having been left out. The party that's in power now has built its reputation also on some very significant false narratives about Polish history, and in particular about the really tragic death of the former president, who was the twin brother of the leader of Law and Justice, and a number of senior Polish officials when they were en route to a commemoration of the Katyn Forest massacre in Russia. And that narrative, that false narrative that that party has built up, has been sort of what they have stoked their attack on institutions with. The other thing that we'll get to later that's relevant is that this party won the election and came to power in 2015 in the midst of the refugee crisis at that time, with refugees flooding into Europe and with the European Union trying to get all EU member states to take significant number of refugees. And that party used that issue very much to its advantage. But that doesn't represent all Poles. And the other main political party, which led Poland for 10 years from 2005 till 2015, is the party that sees itself as the modern force, the party that sees membership in EU as security for Poland, and who appeals to those Poles who probably have done better. So it's not just urban rural, but there are some similarities to the splits in the U.S. One thing in Polish politics that there is not really division over is that both sides see the relationship with the United States as crucial, and they want a close relationship. And both sides see Poland's membership in NATO as critical, and they reject any discussion of, expanding NATO made Russia mad, so maybe we shouldn't have done it. And Poles of all political stripes will say, we have the right to determine our future. So it's an interesting point of agreement amongst almost every political stripe in Poland.
Well, that sets a good foundation for what I'd like to bring up next, and that's the Polish economy. Where does Poland stand today with regard to the economy? I mean, have they weathered COVID-19 well? I know the Polish economy was growing rapidly for a long time. Construction was booming. Science and tech fields were expanding rapidly. They do rely heavily on coal for electricity production. And I know that one of the conflicts with the EU right now is that they've been directed to shut down a coal mine near the German border. They do have excellent education and excellent health care. How does their position on the eastern frontier of Europe impact their economy? And how does their reliance on coal impact the need to address climate change, especially as part of the EU's moves to be aggressive on that issue?
Yeah, so a couple of things. Poland's economy, came out, I think you could say there's sort of two sides to that. And it relates to the political issue. So as Poland came out of the communist era, it went through a rapid privatization and, deregulation. And that involved a certain amount of corruption and cronyism that is, again, part of the grievances of Poles who feel they were left behind. Yes. Especially to see some of the communist era people sort of transition quickly into being a capitalist and doing quite well for themselves. But that said, I think there's also a lot of agreement that the size of Poland, the size of its workforce, it's already high and now even better education system meant that, and the process of becoming an EU member meant that Poland was a great place for foreign investors to bring, you know, manufacturing and other kinds of things. And because of the educational system and the high level of university education, especially in the scientific and technical fields, and then the increasingly over the years, the growing English language capacity of those educated people, you know, really meant that Poland was well positioned to then keep that university, you know, so you have a strong economy, you can continue to invest in your universities and your healthcare. And so, for example, you know, Poland used to be thought of as, you know, a poor country, and there are parts of Poland that are still quite poor, but it has really moved ahead. And I think it's weathered the COVID crisis. I mean, I think we're all still figuring out who has weathered and who hasn't weathered COVID.
Yeah.
But like I said, it has been an uneven economic growth, and that has an impact on politics. So one thing I know a lot of people ask about, you know, like, does the United States provide economic assistance to Poland? And once it began its process of finalizing its entry into the EU, then the U.S., as with all EU member states, then terminated that economic development because Poland was doing so well that it no longer qualified, and because it receives massive amounts of assistance from the EU, which is kind of ironic that the current government is so anti-EU in its rhetoric. Poland is still a beneficiary of those massive EU development funds that go to the less wealthy countries.
So at this point, we've sort of hit a nexus between the politics and the economic issues and the haves and the have-nots, perception or reality. And right now, there's, and I'm sure people have heard about this on the radio, but there is a bit of a border crisis between Poland and Belarus. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so that has is such an interesting and difficult problem. So the country of Belarus, which sits right to the east of Poland and was part of the Soviet Union, so it was a republic of the Soviet Union, has been ruled by what many call the sort of last of the Stalinist dictators Belarus became its own country. And as I said, you know, even in the time that I was in Poland, there were crises up and down in relationships between all of the EU and Belarus over repression in Belarus. So, and Lukashenko, the president of Belarus, has, I would say, something of a strange relationship also with Vladimir Putin. He wants to be his own guy, right?
Yeah.
And so he wants to be a big fish in his little pond of Belarus. Occasionally over the years, there's talk of Belarus rejoining Russia, but he resists that kind of integration with Russia. But he works very closely with Russia as with regard to relations with the EU. So when there were demonstrations about Belarus last summer over the elections, which were rigged, and arrests of opposition figures, then the EU imposed a number of sanctions on Belarus, more than even had been there before. And it appears that Putin and Lukashenko are working together to build on the internal divisions already existing in the EU by really creating a crisis, first on the border of Lithuania and now even in greater numbers on the border of Poland. And what it appears from all reports are that Russia is assisting Belarus with really recruiting refugees who are in desperate straits. These are people who are in desperate situations, whether they're from Iraq or Syria or other places, and bringing them to Belarus and pushing them toward the border, now with Poland, first with Lithuania. So you have really desperate, among the most desperate people in the world, being instrumentalized by Belarus against the EU. So what it appears Belarus, Lukashenko and Putin's goal is working, because Poland has refused any assistance from the European Frontier Agency called Frontex. And they don't want to get into a conversation in which Germany, for example, tells them that they need to let refugees in. As I said before, this party came to power, won the elections in 2015, based on a real zero acceptance of refugees from the Middle East and Afghanistan. So this came at a time when the EU already is looking at the Polish government's attacks on democratic institutions, whether that's the courts or the free press. So there already was serious fractures in the relationship between the EU and Poland. And now, Lukashenko is instrumentalizing these refugees to create another crisis on Poland's border. Yeah. And it's hard to see where this will go.
We will see. So yeah. I have to admit that there's so much to cover here. Very quickly for our audience, you're listening to KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. This is National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Dr. Mary Curtin, who serves as diplomat in residence at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs, and we're discussing Poland today. So, Dr. Curtin, let's move on to a security discussion. Historically, Poland has been the nation that gets trampled underfoot by armies invading from the west and armies invading from the east. Napoleon comes to mind, as does Germany in both World Wars and the Soviet Union World War II. Today, the Poles are organized along with the Baltic nations of Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia as the northeastern flank of NATO, sort of keeping watch or just observing the actions of a resurgent Russia. And that includes Belarus, frankly, because there's a strong partnership now between Belarus and Russia. Can you tell us a little bit about Poland's defense policies? Let's start there, and maybe we can do some follow-up questions from that.
Sure. So as I said, Poland was one of the countries when the Soviet Union broke up and the Warsaw Pact fell apart. Poland was, along with the Baltic states, I would say, one of the most significant countries to advocate for an expansion of NATO in partnership and alongside an expansion of the EU. So those things went hand in hand, so that they would be fully integrated into not just the economic, but also the defense system of the European states that are members of NATO. And Poland, in a way, when you talk about, how Poland has been at times the country that both Russia, the Soviet Union, Germany, others trample through in order to achieve other goals. It has been occupied, divided. And what one of Poland's security goals is not to be that country anymore, to be a fully functioning member of Europe. And for a long time, there was fairly strong consensus that EU membership and NATO membership were, for Poland, two sides of the same coin, that you create full integration with all of the European mechanisms, including European economies, and you integrate fully into the NATO system of defense. And so Poland has, since it joined, since the expansion of NATO eastward began, Poland has been a strong supporter of the idea that its security comes from its own defense structure and its membership in NATO. So as I described before, from the early 2000s, Poland did a couple of things. One, it has always had a robust political and military presence and engagement at NATO. It participated significantly in the NATO presence, including combat troops in Afghanistan. And it did so explicitly because it wanted to demonstrate that it was a good NATO member. As part of that, Poland also completely retooled its military from a Soviet-era military structure to one that, well, first of all, has strong civilian leadership that trains and makes sure it has the equipment to be interoperable with other NATO member states. But I would also say probably that there is a part of Poland that also wants to make sure it has a very strong military so that it can, if necessary, defend itself, even before or without assistance. The experience of 1939, when it feels that it was, when it was not defended by other countries, is something that many Poles still talk about. And I think it informs the thinking that they need a strong military structure. But I would say that most Poles see that it's sort of all of a package. You know, being a good NATO member, participating in all of the discussions, and then rebuilding that military. So, of course, a really important part of that is the relationship with the United States, including military equipment that it gets from the United States, and training with the United States. And as you may know, there is now a rotational presence. So we don't have the kind of big bases that you see in, in Germany, but there is a rotational presence of US troops. I think I saw it's around 6,000 troops in Poland at any given time. And the Poles, I would say most Poles are very happy to have that presence there.
Yeah, Mary, we're going to run into a little bit of a technical issue here. I'm going to have to ask you if we can both restart our Zoom link.
Okay.
And we'll get that fixed before next week for our second for our next session next week. But let's restart our Zoom link, and then we'll come right back up on the air, if that's okay.
Great. Okay, good.
It'll just take two seconds, folks. Just stand by for a second. And we're bringing Mary back up with us here just a moment. And we're back up. And Mary, you can hear me? Mary, can you hear me now? We're having a little technical problems. Standby, folks. Oh, there we go.
No, I'm moving because while my dog is behaving, there is a woodpecker outside of the house right where I was sitting. So I'm going to move to a different room.
I thought I heard something in the background on your end, but I wasn't sure what that was.
Yeah, no, and I didn't want to move. So I hope your listeners, I hope this is a little bit better.
No, that's good. Okay. So over the course of the last 6 years or so, the U.S. has been adding our troops to Poland's defensive posture. During the Trump administration, that included the idea of building permanent U.S. bases in Poland, mm-hmm. much like we have in Germany. We did not move forward on that. But that does mean that we're putting U.S. troops pretty far forward, right on the
yes.
NATO frontier. And how mm-hmm. do you think that impacts Poland's position vis-a-vis both NATO and Belarus and even Russia, frankly?
So I think I think that in the previous administration, you know, when the Polish president came to Washington and talked about opening, you know, Camp Trump or something like that, I think that kind of bombastic language, thankfully, is gone, because that that kind of overblown rhetoric actually is dangerous, and so because Russia. already, as we discussed, Russia has not been happy at all since, you know, since the late 90s when the expansion of NATO started to become a reality. And certainly since Vladimir Putin became president, the notion that the United States had promised that it wouldn't expand to Russia's borders is something that Putin builds his political reputation on.
Yeah.
And so I think that in general, the United States tries to find a balance between the size and kind of presence that would reassure Poland, that would demonstrate to Russia that we are paying attention to Poland, that we take our NATO commitments to Poland and the Baltic states very seriously, without it becoming a huge base. One thing I would say is that there is not a lot of so Poles are united, I think, generally over the importance of the NATO membership and the reality of what they see as the threat from Russia, which was there even when I was in Poland. That feeling was there when I was in Poland. But I think that maybe then when you get down into the granular aspects of it, I would say that there would be less agreement over how big that kind of presence would be.
Yeah.
You know, this is a country that has had occupying troops and bases on its land for a long time. And so there's a little bit of concern, I would say, over massive presence. But the kind of rotating presence that the United States has now obviously is designed to send a signal. And the signal isn't just to Russia. The signal is to Poland also, that the United States takes its NATO commitments seriously. And I think in general, there, in terms of U.S. policy, there's not a lot of interest in building the kind of massive bases that we have in, you know, Japan, South Korea, Germany, those sort of legacy bases that were built after World War II. I think in general that is not something that, you know, national security policymakers across the board, you know, are interested in doing. But this kind of rotational presence that we have right now in Poland is not just good for Poland, but it's also, I think, an approach that you know, that fits in with broader national security policy.
Yeah.
So that approach is well coordinated with NATO, and it's related to things like, you know, flyovers for the Baltic states that don't have that kind of capacity. So it's pretty well coordinated approach to demonstrating to our allies that we're serious and demonstrating to Russia that, you know, that we are also serious.
Yeah. So let me hit you with the big question now. Mm-hmm. So Poland sits on that border with Belarus. So Belarus mm-hmm. is between, well, in theory, Poland and the main part of Russia, and then you have mm-hmm. Ukraine as well. There's a pretty long border there for Poland. But Poland does actually sit right next to Russia with the mm-hmm. oblast of Kaliningrad. Mm-hmm. And that small oblast is just on the northern side of Poland, right on the Baltic Sea. It's Russian territory, heavily armed, a lot of mm-hmm. military, Russian military
yes.
there.
Yeah.
Russia takes full advantage of the strategic positioning mm-hmm. of Kaliningrad to threaten or deter, depending mm-hmm. upon your point of view, the NATO alliance and the European Union, frankly. Mm-hmm. How does Poland view Kaliningrad from a defense policy perspective? Is that just a place where you whistle while you walk past it, sort of like a cemetery late at night? Or are the Poles deeply concerned about Kaliningrad?
I think that the Poles have been deeply concerned about Kaliningrad for a long time. You know, Russia has been stationing various short, medium-range missiles, things like that, going back, again, to the early 2000s. I think, actually, I would say a lot of Polish policymakers view it a little bit in both ways, that it is both an annoyance and something that they don't want to talk too much about because it is Russian sovereign territory. And they don't want to get into a discussion about who can do what on their own sovereign territory, right? So if Poland tells Russia, you can't do this, then Russia could tell Poland, well, you can't have American troops there. So I would say that Poland has for a long time kept a very close eye, along with NATO allies, you know, on what exactly Russia has positioned in Kaliningrad militarily, without making a big deal about it. And then, you know, also there's this sort of strange, you know, as you said, it relates also to the EU. So Kaliningrad was old East Prussia,
right,
and just the anomalies of the Soviet Union, the breakup of the Soviet Union, left that little piece of Russia on the other side of the Baltics when the Soviet Union broke up and the Baltic states declared their independence. And so it gives Russia access to the Baltic Sea, but not directly. It has to go through some other country to get there. There's a fair amount of economic activity. For example, if you go to the lake resorts in northern Poland, you will often see Russians visiting who come from Kaliningrad, and they like, so I would say that there has been this sort of uneasy calm around Kaliningrad, that where it doesn't get put on the front pages, but where everybody's watching it. So they're not just whistling past the graveyard. They are actively keeping an eye, and I'm sure in the U.S. as well. So
sort of a let sleeping dogs lie kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's probably pretty smart. So what else should people know about Poland? Maybe, you know, we talked a little bit about politics, the economy, a little bit about defense policy. You've mentioned a little bit about the people. What else should they know about Poland today? I think you touched on a little bit of some of the political things that are happening and the impact for both the EU relationships and frankly, the relationships between the U.S. and Russia over Polish relations. So I'll give you the floor, maybe give you a few minutes here to just tell us what else we need to know about Poland.
Great. I think that it's important for Americans to understand that I think, and a lot of people whose opinion I respect, think that Poland is really at a turning point. There are many, many Poles who treasure the democracy that they have. They treasure being a sort of normal country that's deeply integrated into the EU, and see themselves as Europeans. That is what they wanted. They don't want to be a quote buffer state. They want to be Europeans, and they want to be part of that. And they want to, they're very proud, very, very proud of their history and of who they are, and see themselves as, you know, what they are, a large country that sits in a strategic position, that can and should be a significant player in European institutions, including the EU and NATO, both. But those people feel that the current government is in an effort to stay in power, really undermining the democratic institutions that they worked so hard to build, and undermining Poland's position within the EU. And so I think that there's a lot of very well-placed concern about which path Poland will take. I think that anyone who looks at Poland should remember that when you read about, say, the government, that doesn't represent all of Polish thinking. And that, you know, that it'll be interesting to see how this goes forward.
Well, elections have consequences, and
they do.
We'll see what the next elections have.
Give
Poland. So, Dr. Curtin, we've come to the end of another edition of National Security This Week. Thank you so much for joining us today to talk about Poland and a little bit about your career path as a Foreign Service officer. Anything else you want to talk about? What's happening? What courses are you teaching at Humphrey
right
now?
So this fall, in addition to doing the crisis exercise, I'm teaching a course on U.S. foreign policy, in which we look at some of the critical issues that are facing U.S. foreign policy, as we see things like, you know, the emergence of China. We're actually talking about Russia today in my class, and the sort of challenge that Russia poses, and you know, how the United States should think about that. You know, we look at assistance programs and, you know, the question of militarization of foreign policy. So it's a really interesting and broad ranging course. So, but thank you so much for having me on. And I hope that your listeners learned a little something about Poland and about U.S. relations with Poland.
Well, I know I did. So, all right, folks, that closes this week's edition of National Security This Week. We're on KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. I'm your host, John Olson. Thank you for joining us today. Look forward to sharing time with you again next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. We would love your feedback on National Security This Week here at KYMN Radio. So please take a few minutes and contact us and let us know how we're doing. Thank you, everyone. Have a great finish to your week.
You've been listening to National Security This Week, a weekly show looking into issues of American national security with the host, John Olson. Listen every Wednesday at 9 a.m. for National Security This Week.